This is the Stella Culinary School Podcast, episode 25, Thanksgiving Day Sides. Hello and welcome to our part two discussion on Thanksgiving. Last episode we mastered turkey, this episode is the sides. In this episode we're going to talk basic sides, including the science behind great mashed potatoes, going to be revisiting that. Some stuffing, gravy, Brussels sprouts, hey, I'll make you like Brussels sprouts, I will. And cranberry sauce. So break out your chef coats and aprons, it's time to go to class. And this is the Stella Culinary School Podcast, found online at stellaculinary.com. My name is Jacob Burton, and thank you for joining me in part two of our Thanksgiving Day episode series, whatever, right? I'm so excited. I love Thanksgiving so much. Thanksgiving is an awesome holiday because it's all about getting together with your friends and family and sharing food, right? And nothing offers a better bonding experience than just getting together and eating and drinking and being merry. Christmas is a great holiday, but you know, around Christmas, it's all about the buying the presents and gift wrapping, and you got to go get a tree. And I mean, it's just, Christmas is really fun when you're a kid, and what I found personally as I got older, I mean, it's awesome seeing my daughter's eyes light up on Christmas Day, and she's already harassing me to get a Christmas tree. And I'm like, chill out, sweetie, I mean, it's not even Thanksgiving yet, okay, it's way too early to get a Christmas tree. So she's all excited. So as a parent, seeing that excitement in her eyes makes Christmas really special for me. But outside of that, when you're an adult, Christmas kind of turns into a big pain, right? Thanksgiving is great, because it's just getting together and sharing food and eating. Now, Thanksgiving can be a pain if you don't plan properly, especially if you're the one stuck in the kitchen, right? So you're stuck in the kitchen and you're stressing out and everyone else is having a good time, but maybe you're not having the best time because you feel that pressure. You want to feed your friends and family this amazing Thanksgiving Day dinner that you've been planning for weeks and weeks, if not months. And when it comes to be go time, you're a little bit stressed out. So in this episode, besides talking Thanksgiving Day sides, we're also going to be talking about execution and kind of how to plan your execution to take the pressure off of you a bit. Now, in our previous episode, in Stella Culinary School Podcast episode 24, we discussed turkey and my preference for breaking it down and treating those parts separately. And as promised, I did a big content dump and released 6 brand new videos just on turkey. And they're meant to be watched in a series. So the first video, we start with a whole raw turkey. And again, in the last episode, I argued for breaking down your turkey and just treating it separately because the breast will cook differently than the legs and thighs. So you need to apply different techniques. So in video 1, we break down the whole turkey. In video 2, we make a roasted turkey stock, which is very similar to making a chicken stock. So if you're familiar with that, then you can probably even skip over that video. Then I show you how to take that breast, dry salt to make sure that it holds in and retains all of its moisture, and we pan roast it. In the pan roasting, not only does the breast come out beautiful, the skin is a crisp golden brown, and it looks gorgeous, but it's moist and tender. And off of a 14-pound bird, to pan roast those 2 large turkey breasts, I could get it done in a large 12-inch skillet, and it took me 20 minutes to pan roast from start to finish, maybe 25 tops. 25 minutes to get those breasts done, all right? Then I took the legs, and I took the tenders from the breast. So you have that little strip of muscle meat that is different from the breast, and it has that large tendon that runs through it. So I showed you in the breakdown video how to strip that tendon out and then roll it up in a turkey leg roulade. So we took the turkey leg and we deboned it. And that's nice because you have all those feather bones that get in the way of eating. So you have those calcified tendons that are just a pain in the butt to eat around when you roast those turkey legs whole. So we deboned it. So we had nothing but just meat. It's pure meat. And we use those bones in our stock. And then we wrapped inside that deboned turkey leg the chicken, or excuse me, the turkey tendon, or tendon. The tendon was removed from the tender. It's very confusing. It's not that confusing when you watch the video, though. And so what you have is this beautiful roulade that we then steamed, and then you cut this cross-section, and you have this dark meat that has a beautiful, tender white meat inside, right? And I talk about in the video and also in the show notes of that video how you can take this leg and you can cook it sous vide, how you can finish it via roasting or deep frying, which I actually demonstrated in the video. And then we take our, if that's not enough, we take our stock that we make and we turn that into a beautiful gravy using a couple of tips and tricks, you know, to make just a delicious brown roasted turkey gravy. And because we're breaking everything down the day before or a couple days before and making that stock, we don't have to wait for our bird to be ready and done roasting to make our gravy. So if you haven't already, go ahead and you can either go and review last episode. You can find last episode at stellaculinary.com/SCS24. And that's our short code for that episode. It'll have links to all the videos, but also the show notes for this episode found at stellaculinary.com/SCS25 will again have links to all of the videos. And I might just have a few more videos up my sleeve, not promising anything because I don't want to disappoint you, but I got some product to shoot with. It's just becoming crunch time. It's coming, you know, we're a few days away from Thanksgiving at this point. So, you know, I'm going to try and get as much done as I possibly can so you guys can just totally rock it in your kitchen this Thanksgiving. All right, so in today's discussion segment, or this episode's discussion segment, we are going to be discussing our Thanksgiving Day sides. And this is what brings everything together. So step one is to make sure you're mastering your turkey, right? Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. Do not collect applaud and praise from your family and friends if you mess up the Thanksgiving Day turkey. Okay, that's primary goal number one. And that's why we spent an entire episode talking about Thanksgiving Day turkey and why I shot a 6-video series on the subject. So you should have a pretty good starting point, a pretty good idea. Now, if you have questions on that, you can always just go to stellaculinary.com/SCS24 and you can ask your questions there and I will answer them in an upcoming Q&A podcast episode. So one of the most important sides, well, there's a couple really important sides for Thanksgiving because Thanksgiving just isn't Thanksgiving without stuffing, mashed potatoes, and gravy. That kind of rounds out your dish. Now, you do need some vegetables, you do need some greens, maybe a casserole or two, but a lot of that stuff can be brought by your family and friends. Okay, so you assign food or you give them an idea of what to bring, right? And we'll talk a bit about that more in our menu planning segment when we talk about execution. So for me, though, because everything is so interlinked, I like to make the turkey, the gravy, the stuffing, and the mashed potatoes. Because as long as those three things are home runs, or even just decent, right? But I mean, come on, let's be honest, they're going to be home runs. As long as they're good, though, everything else is just, it doesn't really matter. It falls by the wayside, you know? So you got a soggy salad, you got an overcooked green bean casserole, you got some stale dinner rolls, not a big deal, right? Because you have awesome stuffing, gravy, mashed potatoes, and a beautiful turkey. Preferably a breast and leg that have been cooked separately, which is going to add a lot of wow and appeal. All right, so in last episode, we talked about how to break down your whole turkey and make a stock. And again, I have a video on that. So for me, that's an important part of my Thanksgiving Day workflow because traditionally speaking, gravies are made right at the end. So you have a roast, whether it's a turkey or a beef roast or whatever it is, and normally you'll take the juices in the fat that have seeped out during that roasting process, you'll remove the turkey, allow it to rest. And while the turkey's resting, you make a gravy. And normally what you'll, I mean, so best practice for this is to pour the juices off out of the pan and into a gravy separator. And a gravy separator looks just like a measuring cup, except it has a long spout that is attached at the bottom. And as the fat floats to the top, and the liquid or the juices from the roast sink to the bottom. You're able to pour off those juices and keep the fat behind. Now, this fat can be placed back in the roasting pan and cooked with an equal amount of flour by weight, and this is going to give you your roux. Now, at this point, you pour the juices back in, but you really don't have a whole lot of juices, so your gravy's not going to go that far. So this is why people resort to maybe using a canned chicken broth and gravy packets, and it's okay, but just never comes out that good. And you know what? I mean, I'm going to be honest with you for a second. First of all, homemade gravy with a homemade stock is always going to be superior and awesome, but there's a little special place in my heart for instant gravy. I said it. Yeah, I mean, there's certain flavors from your childhood that you resonate with, right? So making a gravy that with a flavor packet isn't the end of the world. However, it can be so much better. So part of your workflow is to make that gravy ahead of time with a homemade stock. And when you get everything organized and you start being, you know, proactive instead of reactive to your Thanksgiving Day process, you're going to have not only a better end product like a homemade scratch gravy using a roasted turkey stock that you made yourself, but you're also going to have an easier workflow. So you're not sitting there whisking constantly at the end, trying to finish the gravy and figure out why it's lumping and, you know, making it taste good and not too thick or not too thin while your turkey's getting cold. So for me, my workflow is this. I'll break down the turkey and I'll make my stock, usually the day I break it down. Now I have this stock reserved, and half of that stock I'll save for turkey soup for leftovers, right, for the day after Thanksgiving. And the other half of that stock I will save for gravy. Now I have a big lecture video on what I call the three modern mother sauces. We talked about the five French mother sauces in our sauce series, but the three modern mother sauces are my technical-based approach to making sauces, right? Because the French mother sauces are pretty redundant, and you can review that series. But the point being is reduction is one of the three techniques that will allow you to create any sauce in your imagination, right? And a gravy is just a subcategory of a reduction because you're using a stock. Now, I'm going to put a link to this lecture video that's about a half hour long in the show notes if you want to dive deeper. But suffice to say, when you're making a gravy and it falls underneath the reduction sauce category, then that means that the best practices of a reduction are going to be used. I'm going to walk you through that right now. So you have your roasted turkey stock. Okay. Now, for me, a gravy just isn't gravy unless it has a roux in it. Okay. Just the roux brings something to the party. It brings a certain viscosity. It brings that brown, nutty aroma if you're using a brown roux, which I always do because I prefer a brown gravy. So you're using this roux, which is equal parts flour and fat cooked together to thicken your turkey gravy. Now, the first step is when you're making that homemade turkey stock, when you're skimming that stock, you're basically pulling off all that fat that floats to the top. So what I like to do is I reserve that skimmed fat in a container. And then later on, I will pour that fat through a strainer into a small nonstick pot. That's because the fat still contains some water in it. So then what I'll do is I'll just put it on a low flame and let it simmer. And when it stops simmering, and you want to make sure that you're doing this over low heat, because if the heat gets too high, the fat's going to scorch and burn. Now, I will warn you, the fat will darken because there's still going to be a lot of particulate matter in this fat. But don't let that scare you, because once it's mixed with the flour, it's actually going to add a nice roasted flavor. And you can watch this whole process in my gravy video. But I'm skimming the fat from the stock, I'm passing it through a strainer into a small separate pot, and I'm simmering over low flame. And once it stops simmering, I know that I've cooked all the water out. Now I can take this fat and then I'll supplement in some butter, because you normally don't yield enough fat to make the amount of roux that you'll need to thicken the gravy. So I will supplement in some butter and I will use that butter and turkey fat mixture to cook my flour to make the roux. So now I'm using this turkey fat to reinforce my turkey flavor. Now I'll cook it. I like to cook my roux pretty dark, right? I like to go real dark brown because I like that strong, nutty, flour, toasty aroma and flavor that a dark roux gives my turkey stock. But that's just personal preference. Either way, though, you want to make that roux ahead of time, and you can make it literally a few days ahead. And you always want to make a little bit more than you think you'll need, because you never know when you might need to use a little bit of a last-minute addition of roux. And then you want to set that aside on a sheet tray or in a jar to cool. Now, be careful. When you make a dark roux, that thing, it's flour and fat cooked together. There's no moisture, so its heat is not limited by the boiling point of water. So it can get really, really hot. So you can burn yourself, and if you put it on the wrong plate or the wrong tray to dry, you might burn that plate, or, I mean, you know, God forbid you put it in a plastic container, right? It's going to burn right through it. So this stuff is hot. It's napalm, okay? So put it on like a metal sheet tray is best, and just set it aside at room temperature and let it cool. Now, once it's cooled, I mean, it really is just fat and flour mixed together, so you can actually let it sit in a airtight container at room temperature for a day or two. But if you're squeamish about that, just pop it in your fridge, and then you have your roux ready to go. Okay, so now you have your turkey fat roux, which is going to bring so much flavor to the party, and your homemade roasted turkey stock set aside. Now, the day of, what I'll do, and you can do this in the morning before you even roast your turkey, because there's no problem with bringing gravy back to temperature or keeping it hot in a bain-marie or even a crock pot. Crock pots work great for keeping gravy and mashed potatoes hot. So day of, what I'll do is I'll do what's called a reinforcement and reduction step. So I will take fresh aromatics. I prefer to use the French mirepoix, which is carrots, celery, onions, and I'll do some crushed garlic cloves and some sliced ginger, all skin on, because I'm going to strain it out later, and to me the skin adds a little bit more of an earthy flavor, more depth of flavor, which I enjoy. And just make sure you wash off any surface dirt first. And so I'll take these chopped up vegetables, and I will saute them in the bottom of a large sauce pot. Right, and what I'm trying to do here is, and I'll put a little bit of cooking oil or clarified butter, and what I'm trying to do here is toast them. And this is, again, just going to reinforce that roasted flavor into my gravy. And what you'll see is you'll see a fond build up in the bottom of that sauce pot, and that fond is all sorts of just yummy deliciousness, right? It's all that brown, usually, you know, sugars and some proteins from the vegetables. So you want to make sure you harvest that fond, because number one, if you don't, if you let it just stick to the bottom of that pot, it's going to scorch. But number two, if you don't harvest that fond, it's just wasted flavor. Now, I like to deglaze with white wine only because I think red wine is a little bit too strong of a flavor for a roasted turkey stock. Just my personal preference. But whether you use white wine, red wine, or just water, you want to add enough to cover the bottom of that pot, you know, by maybe a quarter of an inch. In my video, I start with a gallon of turkey stock, so I'm using 2 cups of white wine to deglaze. And you bring that white wine up to a simmer, and then you use the edge of a wooden spatula to scrape that fond as it simmers, right? And so now you're taking that fond and you're bringing it into the white wine and dissolving it. Now you want to make sure you reduce your white wine by at least half, because if you don't, what's going to happen is that raw alcohol taste is going to stay and sort of permeate your gravy. Now once you've reduced the white wine by half, now you add in your turkey stock, which at this point is probably cold because you made it a day or two ago. So you add in your turkey stock, and while you're waiting for that to come up to a simmer, you want to whisk in your brown roux. Now, the reason why you don't want to add your roux while it's hot is because, again, the roux, the fat and flour mixture get much hotter than the boiling point of water. So when you take a really hot roux that is above the boiling point of water, and then you stir it into water, which in this case is your turkey stock, it's going to boil super vigorous, and it's going to break apart rapidly, right? So you're going to have a separation of your fat and flour, so it's going to lead to a greasy gravy with clumps of flour. So this is why you want to make your roux ahead of time and let it cool to minimum below boiling point temperature before it's added to your stock. But I mean, you know, why not just make it the morning of or the day before or a couple days before? You know, it'll be fine in your fridge, right? So there's no reason. I mean, so anything you can really do ahead of time, you should do ahead of time, because that way on the big day, on Thanksgiving Day, all you have to worry about is execution. So now you're bringing this up to a simmer, okay? And for a standard gravy, you would use 6 ounces of roux to thicken 1 quart of liquid. And that's going to give you a thick gravy. And you still want to, it's still best practice to simmer that gravy for about 20 minutes. Because what's going to happen is as that roux is incorporated into the gravy, the proteins in the flour are going to get thrown off in the form of scum. So you're always going to have this scum rising to the top. And you need at least 20 minutes to skim a good portion of it away so your gravy doesn't look scummy. And the best way to do this is just to bring it over to a simmer over, say, medium heat, even medium low if you're worried about over reducing, and then pull the pot halfway off the burner. This way, the hot side of the pot that's on the burner is going to simmer gravy up to the top, bringing the scum with it. And then as the gravy cools on the cold side of the pot, the liquid's going to drop back down, leaving that scum on the top, all collected on one side. So you can just conveniently go in with your ladle and skim it off. But for me, an extra refinement step is I actually like to add less roux than I know I'll need, right? And then finish my thickening through reduction. So in the video, I start with a gallon of homemade roasted turkey stock, and then I add 16 ounces of a toasted turkey roux. 16, yeah, because it's 8 fat and 8 flour. Sorry, I had a brain fart there for a second. So I add that to my roasted turkey stock, and then I reduce it by half. So I'm yielding about a half a gallon, if not a little bit less, over the course of maybe an hour and a half. And this extended reduction time not only throws off a lot more scum from the roux, so I'm able to skim more, it also gives me a finer textured mouthfeel. So it's going to give me a really nice velvety mouthfeel. And also, when you add roux to a sauce, when you thicken the sauce with roux, like a gravy, you'll notice that it becomes opaque. And that opaque color, where it's not, it's kind of like dull, it's not really shiny, that comes from the proteins in the flour refracting light. So when the proteins from that flour get shot off in the form of scum, when you skim all of that flour away, you're going to be left with a glossy gravy. And you'll see in my gravy video that because I reduced by half over medium heat for about an hour and a half, I had the opportunity to skim a lot of the scum off, and you'll see that instead of my gravy being dull and opaque, it has a nice, beautiful sheen to it. Now, once the gravy has been reduced by half, I'm going to strain it. And when you get close to the straining process, where you know, you're looking at it and you're like, okay, it looks like it's almost at a halfway reduction point. I'm going to strain it in about 10 minutes. This is a great time to add fresh herbs that you would want to strain out later. So something like a woody herb. I prefer thyme. I love thyme in my gravy. I love thyme in my reduction sauces in general. So maybe, you know, a handful of thyme sprigs goes in there. And fresh, of course, because what this is doing is it's giving it 10 minutes to permeate this, the gravy. But if you cooked it for longer in the gravy, you're going to lose that less fresh thyme flavor, right? It's going to become more of a background note. So adding fresh herbs right at the end, or even fresh spices right at the end, are going to bring those flavors to the forefront. Now you take that stock it's now a gravy. You take that beautiful gravy that's been reduced by half and pass it through a strainer and then strain it again into a smaller pot. So I like to pass, because again, you still have those vegetables in there from, you know, that you use to reinforce the flavor. So your mirepoix, ginger, garlic, right? It's still in the stock. And now it's given all of its flavor to that gravy. So you're going to strain those vegetables out using a bit of a larger strainer. And then just because it was beaten into me for years in fine dining, I like to strain it again in through a finer strainer like a chinois. And in my video, I just use a cone strainer that I picked up for the cheap, you know, $15. But it has a fine mesh on it. And that's going to remove any particles, right? And a little pro tip is any particle that is above 7 microns will register as grit on your palate. You can actually feel those particles. So you want to get if you want to get technical about it, I mean, just, you know, if you're like, hey, Jacob, you know, this is way too technical for me, and your eyes are rolling back into your head, just buy a what's called a fine mesh strainer. But if you really want to get technical about it, you want to make sure that your fine mesh strainer has a mesh that is smaller than 7 microns, okay? And that's going to give you, make sure that you get all of that particulate matter out of your gravy and give you that really finely textured mouthfeel. So then I'll strain it into a smaller pot through my fine mesh strainer, bring it up to a simmer, and add a couple ounces of cream. And this heavy cream is going to just smooth everything out. It's going to give me a nicer mouthfeel. The fat's going to give the gravy some delicious richness. It's going to bring a lot of love to the party. And then I'll bring it, because I added gravy, or excuse me, since I added cream, I added more liquid, right? So I want to bring it back up to a simmer and just gently simmer, again, skimming any scum that may come to the surface, just to check for final consistency. Okay, so I'm going to dip a spoon in there, and I'm not looking for a really thick, gloppy gravy. I'm looking for something that readily coats my spoon when I dip it in, right? And that's enough for me, because this gravy is already going to have a ton of flavor, so you don't need it to be super, super thick, okay? Now, you're going to finish with a squeeze of lemon, and that lemon juice is really going to cut through the richness of that gravy and take it to the next level. And your final task is to check for seasoning, okay? And at this point, because you have a reduced gravy and you got a lot of flavors going on, you may not need any salt, right? But you always want to check for salt, and you can even add a little pinch of white pepper right at the end. Also, too, this is a good opportunity to stir in some fresh minced chives or any sort of tender herb, because it's going to give it a visual pop, but it's also going to taste nice. So now instead of having, you know, now you have this beautiful homemade gravy and you have some chives stirred into it so it looks pretty. And so this can be served immediately, or you can just hold it on the back of your stove, or even just, you know, you can take the whole pot, right, and just put it off to the side somewhere in your kitchen where it's not getting in the way. And you can easily bring it back up to a simmer right before serving. And if you have a lot of people coming over and they're going to just kind of, you know, lazily work their way through the buffet line that you have set up, then a crock pot is a really good option. So now you just put the gravy in the crock pot. Now, one thing that'll happen is the crock pot, as the gravy generates steam inside the crock pot and the lid is on, that steam will condense and it'll drop water back into your gravy, which isn't a big deal. But just if you have it sitting there for a while with the lid on, right before you call people to dinner, take the lid off and give the gravy a good stir, right? And now you have a piping hot gravy that's homemade and absolutely delicious. I mean, come on, how many people make a homemade gravy with a homemade roasted turkey stock? You are going to be a total stud in the kitchen. All right, so that's gravy. Let's talk stuffing. Stuffing for me is really dressing, right? In last episode, I talked about the dangers of stuffing your bird. But also, too, I like to have control over my cooking. My job as a chef has always been to sort of visualize all these possible potholes that I could fall into, whether it's during prep, during service, whatever. And they're always variables, right? So the less variables you have, the more control you will have. So you want to always, in your planning stage, you want to remove variables from your planning. So for me, stuffing my bird is just another variable that I don't want to deal with, because, you know, maybe my bird is dripping too much liquid into my stuffing, and maybe I have to overcook my bird to make my stuffing safe to eat. And really, I want to be able to break down my bird beforehand so I have the stock to make, you know, a stuffing with, or make gravy with, or to use for soup, right? So I prefer to make what's technically dressing, if you want to be technical about it, but I'm going to call it stuffing because, you know, it's still stuffing, only better. And I like to make it just in a casserole dish. And all good stuffing start with stale bread. So it doesn't matter if you're using cornbread, French bread, brioche that you baked in at your house, right? You can even use croutons, even seasoned croutons. My mom makes a killer stuffing, and she just does it with, I don't even think she uses seasoned croutons. But you need stale bread, right? Because that stale bread is going to soak up all of your liquid. And that's going to give you a ton of flavor during the stuffing cooking process. So for me, my favorite stuffing is done with brioche. And I'll put a link in the show notes because I have a recipe for brioche bread. And I'm going to be honest with you, it might be a little bit too much for you to tackle to make brioche bread just to cube it up, and stale it out and use it for your stuffing. But look, if you want to be a total culinary gangster, I mean, then more power to you. It's going to come out awesome every single time, right? So that is an option available to you. A lot of the times, though, I'll go out and I'll buy French bread from the store. And you just get that big, airy, kind of tasteless French bread. And I'll cube it up and let it dry overnight in my kitchen. Just leave it on a sheet tray or, you know, whatever is convenient for you. Just leave it out uncovered. And I live in a pretty dry environment, so it, you know, it works pretty well for me. Now, if you live in a moister, more humid environment, what you might want to do is just toast it in a low oven. So you set your oven to maybe 225, because if it browns too rapidly, then you're still going to have a lot of interior moisture. So you just set your oven to, say, 225, 250, and leave it in there for a good, you know, 4 hours. And, you know, check it, make sure it's not burning on you. But that's just going to drive out all of the moisture. Because right now, that the moisture contained in that bread is just water. It doesn't have any flavor. So what we want to do is we want to drive out that flavor of this water and then rehydrate this bread with a flavorful stock or a flavorful liquid. So you have your dry bread. The next step is to add your aromatics. And I like to just make a whole mixture of things. So for example, the other day, I was making a sausage gravy. I was shooting video on it. I haven't published the video yet. I don't know if I will or not. But I was making a sausage. I said sausage gravy. I meant sausage stuffing. And so what I did is I started with an Italian sausage, and I sautéed it in the bottom of a pot, and then I added in my fine brunoise of mirepoix, carrot, celery, onions, a little bit of minced garlic, and cooked this all together. Now, on top of this, I added water, and because I'm kind of a technical guy, I added 3 times by weight the amount of water that I had to bread. So I took my bread, I cut it up, I weighed it on my gram scale, and I added 3 times the amount of water to my sausage mixture in the pot and brought that to a simmer and then reduced by a third. So that way I have 2 times water, flavored water, in my pot as compared to the weight of my bread, okay? But really all you need is enough flavorful liquid to moisten the bread completely. You're looking to sog this bread out. And so what I did is, so you can use a turkey stock here or a chicken stock, homemade, and it's going to turn out awesome. It's going to be amazing. However, when you break down one 14-pound bird, which I did in my video, this is perfect for making turkey stock in a 3-gallon stock pot, which is pretty standard in a home kitchen. And because you have the turkey and the mirepoix and you have a little bit of reduction, you're probably going to yield just a little over 2 gallons of turkey stock when all is said and done. Now, the most important thing to use that turkey stock for is your gravy. And then in my opinion, the second most important thing to use that turkey stock for is soup for leftovers, because I love leftover turkey soup, right? It's one of my favorite parts about Thanksgiving. Now, if you're not going to use the rest of that stock for a leftover soup, then you can use it in your stuffing. However, for me, what I used when I was shooting my video, and what I'll commonly use if I'm low on stock, is I used chicken base, right? The powdered stuff. Hell yeah, I use that. And my preference is I like the Knorr's. It's Knorr's powdered chicken base. And what this is, it's salty, chickeny goodness, right? Completely different than a homemade stock. Completely different. So let's not even compare the two. But what it does is as it dissolves into your water, it just brings a salty, chickeny goodness to your water that you can then use to season your bread. Okay, so in a pinch, I like to use Knorr's. It works out really well. So now in this liquid mixture, I have my diced up sausage, my mirepoix, and a liquid that tastes like the sausage, mirepoix, and salty, chickeny goodness. And I'll pour this over my stale bread, and I'll let it sog out. Now, also, too, at this point, you can throw in some dry thyme, some garlic powder, fresh herbs. All are fair game. Also, the giblets in the cavity, that come in the cavity of the turkey, I like to mince those up, saute them, and throw them in with the stuffing as well, right? It's a little bit of giblets in there. You can do diced bacon. Also, mushrooms are very nice. Just get some brown, cremini mushrooms, saute those in some butter until they're golden brown. Throw them into your stuffing mixture, and those mushrooms are going to bring a nice umami flavor to the party. And you take this stuffing and you place it into a casserole dish. And the amount of time that it takes for this stuffing to be done is dependent upon how tall your stuffing is, or its thickness. Because now you have to dehydrate that water, and as that water dehydrates out of the stuffing, it's going to leave behind all the seasonings, and it's going to make the stuffing come together cohesively. So for me, I use a standard casserole dish, and if I fill that baby up, and in my video I kind of overfilled it a bit. If I fill that baby up, I place it in a 300-degree oven for about 3 hours. Until, you know, and at the 3 hour mark, when I stick my knife into the center of it, it comes out almost clean. Not completely clean, but almost. So it's not super gooey. But I like my stuffing to be a little gooey, a little moist. That's just a personal preference of mine. Now, at this point, I'll turn. Now, if you don't like it a little bit moist, right? If you want it to be more, I mean, it's not going to be dry, but if you want it to be more cohesive, almost like a savory bread pudding, then just cook it a little bit longer. Again, at that low temperature, until when you stick a knife or a cake tester into it, it comes out completely clean. Now, this can be problematic from an execution standpoint, because now you have this stuffing in your oven for a very long time. So I always do stuffing. I'll load it in the pan the day before, let it sit in my fridge overnight, and then put it in my oven first thing in the morning. And stuffing, it retains a whole lot of heat. So when you pull it out of the oven, it's going to stay hot for a few hours easily. And stuffing at room temperature is still delicious. And if you need to retherm it, you always just pop it back into your hot oven for, you know, maybe 5-10 minutes right before serving. But regardless, once your stuffing has been in the oven for, you know, at 300 degrees Fahrenheit for about 3 hours, and that knife or that cake tester is coming out almost clean or clean, depending on preference, I like to turn my oven up to 350 degrees Fahrenheit and then brush the top of the stuffing with butter. This is going to help the top of the stuffing brown, and it's also going to help the top of the stuffing from drying out and getting too hard. So then I will bake at 350 for about 20 minutes. Everyone's oven is different, but you know, about 20 to 30 minutes will get the job done. And at this point, because it's been in the oven for so long and it's kind of dry, the top will look a bit dark, almost like you burnt it, but it's not. It's going to be a little bit ugly, I'm going to be completely honest with you. But when people scoop that onto their plate and eat it, they're not going to have any issues with it. It's going to be absolutely delicious. All right, so again, stuffing is just as simple as taking stale bread, cubing it up, whether it's cornbread, French bread, brioche, if you want to be a real culinary gangster, letting it stale and then rehydrating it with a flavorful liquid and then adding in any other flavors to the mix like sausage, oysters, bacon, giblets, sauteed mushrooms, mirepoix, and then you drive that moisture back out by cooking it low and slow in an oven. And as that moisture evaporates, the stuffing comes together into one cohesive unit. Now, a pro tip for my sous vide people out there is you can make a really amazing stuffing, savory stuffing, sous vide. And you need a chamber vacuum sealer to do this. I'm going to walk you through it real quick. And what you do is you, so I, for my ratio, I use 890 grams of dry bread, or let's put it this way. I use one part dry bread to one part egg to two parts stock. So I'll whisk the eggs into the stock, and then I will put the dry bread in that stock, and then it starts soaking. Now, then I'll saute up my aromatics and any other ingredients. So, you know, if you have poultry fat, use it. So poultry fat, giblets, diced mirepoix, celery seed, dry cranberry, all that stuff is fair game, and you can deglaze with a little bit of white wine. And you take that sauteed mixture, and you add it to your stuffing mix, right, which has your two-part stock, one-part egg, one-part bread. Mix it all together, check for seasoning, and then you want to line a 9x5-inch bread loaf pan with plastic wrap. Place your stuffing into that loaf pan all the way up to the edge, and then you want to wrap it a ton with plastic wrap. Just wrap and wrap and wrap and wrap and wrap and wrap and wrap. Because what you're going to have to do next is vacuum seal this in a chamber vacuum sealer. It might work if you have an edge sealer. I haven't tried it with an edge sealer. I've tried it with a chamber vacuum sealer. And what happens is there's so much there's so much air in your stuffing mix that as the chamber starts to pull a vacuum, your stuffing is going to want to expand. So if you don't just completely just wrap and wrap and wrap your loaf pan that has a stuffing in it with your plastic wrap, then as the chamber pulls that vacuum, the stuffing will expand. It's going to basically explode all over your chamber if you don't stop it in time. But then what it'll do, if you wrap it properly, it will suck out all the air and it'll flatten your stuffing so it's at the level of your loaf pan top, okay? So now you have this loaf pan vacuum packed and loaded with a delicious stuffing. And now you want to take some weather stripping, place a little square of weather stripping on the outside, on the very top of your stuffing, and then place a probe thermometer. And the Chef Alarm that I was talking about in last episode, they sell, like, for $4, you can get a probe thermometer that's made for sous vide cooking. You stick your probe thermometer into the center of this bad boy, and you stick the probe through the weather stripping so that way it doesn't break the seal or cause any sort of leaking. And then you sous vide it at 175 degrees Fahrenheit. I'm not sure what that is Celsius. I'll put this in the show notes, though, and I'll look up Celsius. So sous vide at 175 degrees Fahrenheit, and you set your probe thermometer to beep at you when it reaches an internal temperature of 170. And 170 degrees Fahrenheit is the temperature at which an egg custard perfectly sets. Anything below and it's not fully set, anything above it, and your eggs start to flirt with getting scrambled. So the egg custard will perfectly set at 170, at which point you pull the stuffing from the bag, or excuse me, from the circulator. You leave it still sealed in the bag. And what I like to do, if it's what I call souffling up, so now the stuffing has kind of expanded and risen above the lip of the loaf pan, I'll place it in my fridge and I will press it with some weights. Just put a plate on top or anything that's flat. And, you know, put some more, you know, put something that's heavy on top of that. So even like a gallon of milk will work. And let it sit overnight. And what that's going to do is going to chill down completely and make this beautiful, cohesive, sliceable stuffing. Now you can take this as is, reheat it in your oven, right? Just take, you know, you want to unmold it first. So the next day, unmold it out of the loaf pan, place it in your oven. And then you can cut slices from it. Now, in past tests, and this is for, you know, people who are out there in pro kitchens who maybe want to do you know, a composed play on Thanksgiving, I would take slices of this stuffing and I would gently saute it in clarified butter so you get this beautiful golden brown color on both sides, and then I'd stick that in the center of the plate, do a little slice of a turkey leg roulade, little slice of sous vide breast, tiny bit of gravy, some homemade cranberry sauce. It was absolutely gorgeous. So that's a pro tip for all of my sous vide homies out there. All right, turkey check, gravy check, awesome stuffing, check, check, check. Right, the only thing left for you to really master to have an amazing Thanksgiving Day dinner is mashed potatoes. Because again, if you're doing it right, you got people bringing other stuff over, right? So you got someone, you know, picking up a pie or a couple of pies. You got someone bringing over, you know, a couple of salads or some side dishes, maybe some appetizers, clam dip. You know what? Speaking of clam dip, I should contact my younger brother. He makes the most killer clam dip ever, and really, our family get-togethers aren't the same without his clam dip. So Nathan, if you're listening, hit me up. I need your clam dip recipe. All right, so the only thing that you really have left to master is mashed potatoes, okay? And we did a series in our starch series, I believe it was SES 5, on, you know, what I call the three basic starches. So mashed potatoes, polenta, risotto. But I think it's time to kind of revisit mashed potatoes so it's fresh in your mind and maybe even add a little bit of information right before you go to make them for Thanksgiving. So first, we need to talk potato because there's two kinds of potatoes available to you. You have waxy potatoes and mealy potatoes, right? So waxy potatoes have a cellular structure which causes them to basically adhere to one another during cooking, resulting in a solid, dense, yet moist texture. So common waxy varieties include new potatoes, thin-skinned potatoes such as like the white potatoes and the red potatoes. But because waxy potatoes are made up of starches that adhere to one another when cooked, they make a really good choice for salads, gratins, potato cakes, but aren't good for mashed potatoes. What you want instead is a mealy mashed potato or a mealy potato. And the mealy variety has a cellular structure that dries out, bursts, and separates itself from its neighbor when fully cooked. So instead of adhering, it bursts and separates. Now, the fine, dry, and fluffy textures makes these potatoes excellent at absorbing fat, and it will reduce gumminess. Dun, dun, dun. I mean, gummy mashed potatoes. Is there anything worse than gummy mashed potatoes? Maybe a bad pate, but, you know, that's for another day. The most common variety of mealy potato is the russet, which makes great mashed potatoes and is available year-round. Now, a lot of chefs really like Yukon Golds. Jorel Robichon, who is world famous for his palms puree, likes Yukon Golds. Or really, it's something that's close to Yukon Gold. It's some like fancy French potato, which I am quite frankly just completely convinced that it's a Yukon Gold potato that they put a French name on it to, you know, charge you more money for it. But the fact being that I've made plenty of mashed potatoes with Yukon Golds and I don't like it. I think russet's superior, you know, and really, if you follow the best practice for making potatoes, mashed potatoes, you know, start with russets, you know, follow the steps that I'm about to give to you. And, you know, at the end, once you follow all these steps, you're going to have some really great mashed potatoes. And then if you want to be a total psychopath and tweak it just that extra 1%, then you can start playing with other forms of mealy potatoes. Okay. But start with russets. They're the easiest to get your hands on and they work really good. So the first thing to do is you want to peel and cut. Rinse the potatoes until the water runs clear. And this is going to get off the excess starches. Oh, what's that? Oh, wait, you know, what about leaving the skin on? What are you, a savage? Skin on mashed potatoes? No, you can't skin on mashed potatoes. If you want to leave the skin on, the only time it's ever worked successfully for me is with red skin potatoes. But again, red skin potatoes are the wrong potato, right? They're waxy, so they don't make that good of a mash. And, you know, I know a lot of you are pissed off at me right now because I'm hating on, you know, mashed red potatoes, and I'm really not. Look, you take any sort of cooked root vegetable, you smash it a couple of times and you stir in butter, it's going to be good, right? And that's basically, you know, smashed red potatoes for you. But it's not a mashed potato, right? Okay, sorry to bust your bubble. So peel your potatoes, cut them up, and you want to rinse them in cold running water. And it's just like making rice. So when you're rinsing the potatoes under cold running water, at first your water is going to be cloudy. And then as you continue to rinse the potatoes, it's going to become clear. And what this is doing is it's removing the excess starch from your potatoes. And excess starch, if it's left in, is just a, you know, more starch to gum up your mashed potatoes later on. So you want to remove as much starch as possible from the get-go. Now, once you rinse all the starch off the surface of your potatoes, cover with cold water and bring to a boil over high flame and reduce to a simmer until it's fork tender. Now, the reason why we cover with cold water is because the mash or the potato is a root vegetable, so it's made up of complex starches and carbohydrates, They are carbohydrates, okay, but they're complex, right? They're not, they don't break down readily like, say, the cellular structure in a leafy green like spinach. Okay, so what happens is if you take your cut up mashed potatoes and you drop them into boiling water, the exterior is going to cook much faster than the interior. So this is going to lead to uneven cooking. So by the time your interior of your potato is ready to be mashed, the exterior is overcooked, which is going to lead to gummy mashed potatoes. And we'll talk about why that happens in a second. So the number one sin is you don't want to undercook your potatoes, lest your finished product be annoyingly grainy with chunks of potatoes dispersed throughout. I mean, there's nothing worse than biting into what looks like some beautiful creamy mashed potatoes and getting chunks of undercooked potatoes in it. However, the whole point of simmering the potato is to separate its cellular structure so you can coat it with fat. If you overcook the potatoes past fork tender, the cells are going to rupture instead of separate. And when they rupture, they release excess starch, making your mashed potatoes gummy. Okay, so that's why you get gummy mashed potatoes, all right? That and overworking it. So once your potatoes are cooked perfectly to fork tender, and again, if you do a cold water start and you keep an eye on your potatoes, you check them every, you know, after, say, 10 minutes, you're checking them, you know, every couple of minutes, you just pull them on their fork tender. You don't stress yourself out over it, okay? Now, after your potatoes are cooked, it's time to drain and mash. And for the actual mashing process, You want to do either a food mill, potato ricer, or a hand masher, the best of which being, in my opinion, a potato ricer. You can also use a KitchenAid mixer or just a stand mixer with the paddle attachment. Now, whatever you do, if you're mashing your potatoes, so people will be like, hey, I like my potatoes more rustic. And I'm like, by rustic, you mean lazy? And like, no, you jerk. I just like chunks of my potatoes. I'm like, okay. Then hand mashing is fine. But no matter which way you mash your potatoes, if you overwork them, then you're going to have gummy mashed potatoes. All right. So you want to work them as little as possible. That's why I like the food mill, because first of all, I'm a refined fella and, you know, I like some creamy mashed potatoes. I'm not a savage who eats chunky mashed potatoes. I mean, that I may as well just have a baked potato at that point. Just kidding. Kind of. So I prefer the potato ricer or the food mill. The ricer is just a lever action thing where you put your cooked potatoes in it, you press it through, and it spurts right out. So you're not really mixing it or you're doing a whole lot to aggravate the starch in those potatoes. Food mill, you're doing a little bit more aggravation because you're cranking this handle around a food die and it's passing the potatoes through. But as long as your potatoes are cooked properly, you shouldn't be overworking them. And then a hand masher is just how it sounds, just mashing them by hand. And they do come out, chunky, which is fine. You add enough butter to anything, it's going to be delicious. Okay. Speaking of adding butter, this is where people really mess up with mashed potatoes. Okay, so you rinse the starch off, you have the cold water start, you cook the potatoes perfectly, you mash them. Now it's time to take these mashed potatoes and actually turn them into mashed potatoes by coating the starches of that potato with fat. To be honest with you, to really make good mashed potatoes, so measure out the amount of butter and milk that you think you'll need, and then you want to double the butter, okay? Unless you're a health-conscious person, then you need to triple it because you have no idea how much butter it takes to make awesome mashed potatoes. Look, don't be rolling your eyes at me, Mr. Granola, okay? It's Thanksgiving, for Christ's sakes, and have a soul, and make some real mashed potatoes. Just because you want to have a six-pack in the dead of winter doesn't mean everyone else has to suffer. All right, also make sure that you heat your milk and butter together because as the potatoes cool, their starches are going to form an irreversible gel. So not to get too technical on you, but the starches in the potatoes will gel as that temperature drops, just like gelatin gels. And this is why mashed potatoes are never as creamy when they're reheated the following day. They're always awesome, like the day of, fresh, piping hot, right when you make them. But then when you pop them in your microwave the next day to reheat them, they're just never going to come out as creamy and delicious as they were before. This is because you have that starch gel that is irreversible. So for every 1 pound of peeled potatoes, did I say rod? For every pound of raw peeled potatoes, you're going to need a minimum 3 ounces of butter and 1 ounce of cream or milk. So for easy scaling, for all you kind of baker percentage nerds out there, which you know I love you guys, that's how I roll. For 100% peeled potatoes, so you're setting your peeled potatoes at 100%. And I'll have a link to the baker's percentage video in the show notes if you're unfamiliar. So set your raw peeled potatoes at 100%, your butter at 19%, I mean, hell, let's just call it 20 just to get a nice round number, and your heavy cream or milk at 6.5%. So once you peel your potatoes and cut them, just take their weight real quick before you rinse and cook them, and then while you're rinsing and cooking the potatoes, you measure out your milk and butter. So if you have 1,000 grams of cut potatoes, and you want to multiply that by 0.2, which is going to give you 20% butter, or which is 200 grams of butter for your 1,000 grams of potato, and 0.65, which is going to give you 65 grams of milk or cream that you're going to dissolve that butter into and heat. And you want to heat it just below the simmering point. So it's nice and piping hot right before you add it to your mashed potatoes. Now be careful because it will boil over very quickly. So it'll hit a simmer, it'll start to boil over, and it'll make a mess on your stove. So don't leave it unattended. And then once you pour this in, the milk and cream and butter, whatever you're using, into your mashed potatoes, you want to just stir it in very gently. And I like to just fold it in using a rubber spatula. Now, you can use a whisk, but again, the more you work your potatoes, the more you're flirting with turning them gummy. Now, a little sour cream. A little touch of sour cream is always a nice touch. So you can substitute some of your butter for sour cream. Some fresh herbs. I like some horseradish. On Thanksgiving, though, I kind of like to keep it simple. Sorry. Now, if you still don't want to make mashed potatoes with lots of fat on Thanksgiving, right? If you're like, you know what, Jacob, I just do not want to eat that much fat. I really like my six-pack abs, and you can go screw off, right? I mean, you know, who knows? Maybe your dad didn't give you enough hugs when you were a kid or something, and you're all pissed at the world, and that anger manifests itself through, you know, you're serving dry mashed potatoes every year at Thanksgiving. Then, instead, consider my herb-roasted red potatoes, which are absolutely awesome. They're simple, easy to make, always a crowd-pleaser, and only use just a little bit of butter. I mean, come on. Come on, bro. You got to have a little bit of butter in your life, right? So, yeah, you know, use just a little bit of butter and fresh herbs, but they really are awesome. And so if you're looking for a potato alternative to mashed potatoes for Thanksgiving, I'm going to put a link to my roasted red potatoes in this episode's show notes. Now, the final flaw is well-seasoned potatoes. Potatoes are a heavy, starchy, fatty dish. Your mashed potatoes are, okay? Now, as we've talked in previous podcast episodes, fat coats the palate, which will deaden flavors, meaning more salt is required for your mashed potatoes to properly be seasoned. So if you want to get technical about it, you'll need a minimum of 1% to 2% salt based on the weight of your finished mashed potatoes. Now, that is assuming that you did not use salted butter for your mashed potatoes or to make the roux for your gravy. If you did, then just cover yourself in ashes and shame yourself publicly because don't use butter that's salted. Butter is butter. Salt is salt. You need control and you need to be able to add them separately. Give yourself more control. But Jacob, what do you put on your toast? You have to have salted butter for your toast, right? Or you can just have some regular good butter and sprinkle it with a little bit of salt when you spread it on your toast. But look, if you use salted butter for your gravy or your mashed potatoes, you're gonna be sorry. Trust me. You can also stir in some fresh herbs, all that good stuff. And white pepper is nice. I like white pepper in my mashed potatoes. I used to not like white pepper in my mashed potatoes. But white pepper kind of has this funky, barnyardy sort of flavor. And when added in small amounts to mashed potatoes, it actually tastes quite delicious. All right, so if that wasn't enough, I want to talk to you about the science behind mashed potatoes real quick, okay? So for all you food geeks out there, this is for you. So this is if you really want to take your potatoes to the next level. The process I just walked you through is going to give you awesome mashed potatoes every single time. But if you are really a nut job, then check this out. Raw potatoes are about 70 to 80% water, 10 to 20% starch, with the rest being made up of sugars, fiber, minerals, and proteins. Now, when you heat a potato to around 140 degrees Fahrenheit, 60 degrees Celsius, the starch granules begin to absorb water, and at around 160 degrees Fahrenheit, they've swollen to many times their original size. Now, the potato starches have formed a gel, right? Separate and swollen, fully gelled potato cells are the secret to creamy mashed potatoes. But here's the catch. Right now, the potatoes are still too hard to mash because they're being held together by pectin, which doesn't fully break down until the temperature's above 185 degrees Fahrenheit, 85 degrees Celsius. So if you were to mash your potatoes right now, right, if you just cook them to, you know, 160 degrees Fahrenheit, let's say, the force needed to mash those potatoes would rupture the starch cells, as we talked about previously, giving you extracellular starch, leading to the dreaded gummy mashed potatoes. Boo! Now, to make matters worse, as we discussed previously, the same thing happens if you overcook the mashed potatoes because the cells rupture when they're overcooked. And as you mix in your milk and cream, the starch gel forms, giving you, again, gummy mashed potatoes. Now, what the instant mashed potato industry found out decades ago is that if you pre-cook your potatoes for about 20 minutes in a water bath that's held at 163 degrees Fahrenheit, 72 degrees Celsius for 20 minutes, you can reduce the available starches in the potatoes by more than half. When the pre-cooked potatoes are cooled after the starch gel has formed, fancy term here, retrogradation takes place. So starch molecules bond to one another and lose much of their ability to dissolve again in water or milk, even if you later rupture the cells through ricing, mashing, or overcooking. So how do you put this into action? The day before you make your mashed potatoes, if you really want to be a true culinary gangster, you par cook your potatoes for 20 minutes in a 160 degrees Fahrenheit, 70 C degree bath for 20 minutes. I just said 20 minutes twice. That makes no sense. But you do it for 20 minutes, right? Now, if you have an immersion circulator, this is a super simple step because you can set your bath to 160 degrees Fahrenheit, vacuum pack your potatoes that you've already cut and rinsed. So you still want to rinse off excess starch, but you cut them into cubes, you know, just large chunks, rinse them, vacuum pack them, 20 minutes in 160 degrees Fahrenheit, 71 degrees Celsius bath, and Bob's your uncle, right? Who's Bob? He makes awesome mashed potatoes, apparently. Once you pull them from your bath, you just pop them in your fridge and chill them. So you can put them in an ice bath first if you want, still in the vacuum bag, right? And chill them. Now, if you don't have an immersion circulator, you can still do this at home. You just, you know, start with cold water. Your potatoes submerge in the cold water in a pot, and you're going to need some sort of accurate digital thermometer. As you bring that water up to, you know, 160 degrees Fahrenheit, you're just constantly monitoring it, okay? And then you just keep on adjusting your flames to hold the water at around 160 degrees Fahrenheit and let the potatoes go for 20 minutes. Pass them through a strainer or just a colander, shake off any excess water, and let them chill in your fridge overnight. And the following day, you want to just simmer gently until the potatoes are fork tender. Add cream and milk, and voila! You'll never have to suffer from gummy mashed potatoes ever again. Pretty awesome, right? Oh my goodness, look at the time. There's still so much more to cover. Hey, instead of annoying you and breaking this up into another episode, I'm just going to extend this. So look, if you're, you know, if your head is just swimming right now because we've already discussed so much stuff, just hit the pause button, take a break, maybe, I don't know, go for a jog or drink a beer or something. Just chillax and come back to this podcast, you know, when you have a little bit more brain space. But I do appreciate your attention span so far, but I really want to make sure you have a lot of information going into your Thanksgiving. So for people who are new to this style of stuff, you know, they're getting a crash course in Thanksgiving. And for the old pros who've been doing Thanksgiving for years, hopefully you're able to pick out a couple tips and tricks here and there. So the last thing I want to talk about real quick is execution, right? The planning stage and executing your dish. Because, you know, you're really nothing without execution, unfortunately. In my culinary boot camps, I constantly stress execution. And we actually have what we call the F-step equation, because the name of my curriculum that I teach at my boot camp is F-step, stands for flavor, sauce, technique, execution, preparation. And the F-step equation says this: flavor plus technique in parentheses times execution equals any dish ever, right? So the core of any good dish is going to be flavor, structure, and technique. You get a good flavor structure, you use the appropriate technique to enhance that flavor structure, to cook your turkey, right, to make your sauce, then you're going to have a great dish. As long as you can execute it. That's why the flavor structure and technique are in parentheses and multiplied by execution, because it doesn't matter how good your technique is, how good your flavor structure is, if you can't execute it, well, then, you know, nothing else matters. So the first part about execution is mise en place. It's a French term that loosely translates into, you know, putting in place, right? So everything is put in its own place. So you need to be organized and ready to go. And this is why I love breaking down my turkey a couple of days in advance, because I can get ready, you know, I can prep all of my gravy stuff, I can prep all of my stuffing, I can roll up my legs, and if I'm working sous vide, I can even cook my breast and I can even cook my legs a couple of days in advance, leave them in the bag, and then I'm just re-therming and serving on the day of, right? So not only am I giving my guests a higher end product and a higher quality product, but it's easing the execution on me. But being organized is number one, and mise en place is at the core of organization. Now, check out if you have a local restaurant supply store. If you don't, then you can look online. And I like to use what are called ninth pans, okay? Ninth pans. I'll put a link to this in the show notes. In fact, let me write that down so I don't forget. But what ninth pans are is they're little service pans that are used in the restaurant industry. So you, all day long, you're doing your prep and you're filling up these little tiny pans that are rectangular. So they have a smaller footprint than, you know, a bunch of bowls and dishes. And you want to take those ninth pans, fill them up with all of your different ingredients, and they're easily stackable and easy to group. And then you set up those ninth pans in groupings of what you need them for. So you're grouping like items. So all of my prep for my gravy is going to go in a certain area. Maybe I'll take all those ninth pans that have my mirepoix, my minced giblets, my butter, right? I'll have all that stuff ready to go, and I will maybe stack them up and wrap them with plastic wrap, and they'll go into like the left-hand side of my fridge. That way, when I'm ready to make my gravy, I just pull out all of my mise en place all at once, I line it up, and I'm not missing any steps, I'm not missing any ingredients. So this is true for anything that you need to finish your turkey, anything that you need to finish your stuffing, right? You want to have your mise en place set up, and you want to have it grouped as is, okay? You want to have it grouped by what you're using it for. Now, another tip is you want to plan your equipment and your layout, okay? Not everyone has an endless supply of pots and pans. Not everybody has stove and oven space, right? So you want to project ahead and think to yourself, okay, so how am I actually going to pick up and execute this dish? And that's why in our, if you look at the show notes for our turkey roulade and also our turkey breast that I pan roast, the two videos that I posted, I talk in the actual notes section about how to execute these two things together. Sorry about that. I keep on hitting my mic like an idiot. I'm so excited about Thanksgiving. I keep on waving my hands everywhere. So I talked to you about how to execute the breast at the same time with the leg and thigh. And so I want you to watch those videos, but also what you always want to do is visualize your execution. Right before service, how is that going to look like? Right before you start serving your turkey, you know, are you going to have to put it in your oven? What temp is your oven going to be at? Do you need to have other things in the oven? And this is also, too, why you want to plan out who brings what, right? Don't just let, you know, people bring anything they want to your house. Because if everyone decides that they're going to bring a casserole, then you have 10 different casseroles that all need to be put into your oven at the same time while you're trying to execute your turkey. So you want to project all of that out and think about it. Also, having other sorts of heat sources are going to be very convenient. So I like to have my mashed potatoes in a crock pot, my gravy in a crock pot. So you know, ideally, I'll line up a bunch of small crock pots on the counter, and I'll put my mashed potatoes in there, I'll put my gravy in there. And what's nice about the crock pots, it'll keep things warm, obviously. But you can put your mashed potatoes, you can put your gravy in there ahead of time. You know, they'll be fine for an hour or two, no problem. So then, you know, you have extra stove space to saute vegetables or to finish, you know, whatever else you need to finish on the stovetop. Induction burners work well, too. So you can have, you know, I mean, you get like the Burton induction burners, which, by the way, no relationship, even though my last name is Burton. But you have the Burton induction burners. They have good ones that are sub-$100, and they work out awesome, right? And so having an extra burner that you can put off to the side somewhere that you can put a pot on to, you know, simmer your gravy or reduce your chicken stock or whatever you need, anything that's not generating a whole lot of smoke, it's just going to spread out your kitchen and make your execution much easier. So pots and pans, stove space. Also, too, Google knife sharpener. Just Google it. Unless you're just a total stud and you have your stones and you're really good at sharpening knives, usually knife sharpeners will charge you about $3 a blade. That's ridiculously cheap. Okay, so Google knife sharpeners, do it now, contact them, try and meet up with a local knife sharpener before the big day, and get your knives sharpened, all right? Take down your chef knife, take down your slicer, you know, your favorite knives, maybe even your bread knife. Yes, you can actually sharpen bread knives. It's a pain in the butt to do it, but pros can do it pretty easily. And pay those guys $3 a blade, maybe even give them a nice little tip because it's Thanksgiving, you know, give them a couple extra bucks. Because they're really working for peanuts. And have some razor-sharp knives to use for Thanksgiving. Okay, because nothing's worse than trying to do all this chopping and all this slicing without razor-sharp knives. All right, so your checklist is get your mise en place set. And try and minimize your mise en place space by getting pans that don't take up a massive footprint. So, you know, go out, buy some small deli containers or some small, you know, plastic containers that stack. Go to your restaurant supply store and buy some ninth pans. And get your mise en place ready to go. Visualize what you're going to be doing And make sure you have the appropriate pots and pans to do it. So if you're doing a lot of pan roasting, you know, you might need to scrub a pan on the fly or something. So just be ready for that. Know what you can do ahead of time. This is something that is really commonly overlooked in home kitchens. People think that you have to cook everything instantly and serve it instantly. You have to be able to roast that turkey and let it rest. So in both the turkey roulade video that I post and in the turkey breast video I post, they need to rest before you slice it, because if you don't, all the juices are just going to spill out and give you a dry piece of meat. Right at the end, too. I mean, so you went through all this trouble to make it awesome and not dry, and then you... There I go, hitting my mic again, sorry. I'm really passionate about dry turkey. Okay, I'm putting my hands down. So you go through this whole process of making this awesome turkey, and right at the end, because you're impatient or you ran out of time, you don't rest the turkey long enough, so you just slice it. And the juices spill out everywhere, and it's a total bummer. So what you want to do is go ahead and pan roast your turkey breast ahead of time. Fry your roulade or roast your roulade ahead of time. About 30 to 45 minutes. And then you leave your oven on. And because your turkey roulade and breast have already been roasted and are perfect, then when it comes closer to service, when you're actually going to slice it and serve, all you need to do is pop them back into a hot oven, about 400 degrees Fahrenheit, 204 degrees Celsius, for about 5 to 10 minutes. Tops. You know, if they haven't been resting for that long, and you do want them to rest minimum 10 minutes, but if they haven't been resting for that long, you know, maybe you only need to pop them in for a couple minutes. So you pop them back in to the oven right before you slice, and what's going to happen is that oven is going to make the surface of that protein hot to the touch. And you slice that protein, you serve it, and when people go through and they put that protein in their mouth, it's going to have the perception of being nice and piping hot, even though the core might be just above room temperature. But for me, I mean, turkey is more of a lazy, casual service anyway. So I'll eat some room temperature turkey with some piping hot gravy and a side of cranberry sauce, just, you know, no problem. It's going to be, you know, that's normally how I roll. And then you take a quick nap in the lazy boy, and then you circle back around and you make a nice room temperature sandwich with those rolls, and got to put some cranberry sauce on there and some turkey breast and whatever else you got, right? And that's round two. So room temperature turkey isn't the worst thing ever, but if you want to make sure it goes out piping hot, then roast it ahead of time, let it rest. And again, this is going to be a lot easier if you're working with your breast and your legs separately, as I demonstrate in my videos. And then right before service, you just flash it in the oven for about 5-10 minutes tops, and you're going to be golden. Speaking of cranberry sauce, in today's culinary quick tip, I'm going to tell you how to make cranberry sauce. It's actually easier than you think. Now, before I tell you the secrets of cranberry sauce, first a little disclaimer. So for years, as a professional chef, I would make cranberry sauce for Thanksgiving, for the restaurant, right? And it's a high-end restaurant. And, you know, so people kind of, they expect a homemade cranberry sauce. That's a little bit fancy. That has some other flavors in it. Like, oh, this is, oh, it's so interesting. He put orange zest and ginger, right? And look, it's delicious. It's absolutely delicious. And people would rave about it, and they'd ask me for my recipe. And then when I would go home to eat Thanksgiving dinner with my family, I would make sure that I stopped by the store and bought a can of cranberry sauce. Not because it's better than the scratch-made version, but because it's a flavor from my childhood, and quite frankly, turkey just doesn't taste right without canned cranberry sauce on it. It just doesn't, okay? So if you make a homemade cranberry sauce, you can definitely wow your foodie friends, and they're going to be impressed, but you're going to want to have a couple of cans of cranberry sauce on hand just because. I mean, come on, you know, it's tradition, all right? It doesn't taste the same unless it's in a cylindrical form and it has those ridges around it, all right? It just doesn't taste the same. But to make your cranberry sauce, so fresh cranberries are extremely sour and bitter, okay? More sour, really. They have a lot of acid in it. So you need to sweeten the cranberry sauce, which means you're going, or the cranberries for the sauce, which means you're going to need a lot of sugar. So making cranberry sauce is really as simple as boiling the cranberries in a simple syrup. And a simple syrup is one part water or liquid. You could use juice, but usually water is fine. One part water to one part sugar. And you can do it by volume or you can do it by weight. It's not really, you don't have to be super precise with this. And that's a simple syrup. So you do one part water, one part sugar, and then you bring that to a simmer, and then you throw in your cranberries. And you want to simmer your cranberries in this simple syrup for a minimum of 20 minutes. And what this is going to do is going to soften the cranberries, break down the cellular structure, but it's also going to release the pectin in the cranberries. There's natural pectin in the cranberries, which is going to allow the cranberry sauce to gel later on. Now, right here, you have a fine cranberry sauce. You can take that cranberry sauce and blend it in the blender to make it smooth and then pass it through a strainer and then chill it. And it's not going to set up completely until you chill it. Or you can leave it chunky. And when I make homemade cranberry sauce, I tend to leave mine chunky just because it differentiates itself from the canned stuff. It says, hey, look at me, I'm special because I was homemade, right? So you don't want to blend it and make it too, you know, make it look too much like the store-bought stuff. But that's just a personal preference. So for me, I like to start with a little bit of minced ginger and some orange rind that I microplane, or so it's basically zest, so orange zest, minced ginger, a little bit of honey, and what else? What am I spacing? I probably should have wrote this down. Sometimes a touch of cinnamon, right? But really just the ginger, honey, and orange is a really nice touch with the cranberries. Now, cranberries and apples also have a flavor affinity for one another. So you can go and buy yourself like some green Granny Smith apples, the baking apples. Take off the peel, dice those up, and throw those in with your cranberries as well. And basically what you're doing is you're adding enough simple syrup, so again, that one-to-one mixture of water and sugar to cover the cranberries. And then you're going to gently simmer for 20 minutes. And then at the end, to give it a little bit of brightness and just a good mouthfeel, you want to take the cranberry sauce off the stove and stir in a tiny pat of butter. And that butter is going to add a sheen to your cranberry sauce and give it a nice mouthfeel when it actually sets up and gels. Now, again, you're setting that cranberry sauce with the natural pectins that's contained in the cranberries. And that pectin gel isn't going to set until it fully cools. So for best results, you're going to want to make your cranberry sauce ahead of time. So just have fun with it. Citrus is awesome. Apple is awesome. But really the basics to a homemade cranberry sauce is cranberries covered with a simple syrup and simmered for 20 minutes and then chilled overnight. All right, this episode's homework assignment is just have an awesome Thanksgiving. We went long. If you've made it this far in the podcast, I'm super impressed. And we covered a lot. So between episode 24 and then this episode of the podcast, we covered so much and was all about having amazing food for Thanksgiving. So your homework assignment is to just be an awesome person, enjoy your family, enjoy your friends. If for whatever reason you're not going to be the one responsible for cooking the turkey or making the mashed potatoes, just be good company. You know, nobody likes a know-it-all, you know. So if you are asked to help, then you can help. If, you know, if people want your opinion, then you can give it. But, you know, if you're not the one making the mashed potatoes or the gravy, just chill out, relax, have some fun, eat some turkey, and really enjoy the spirit of Thanksgiving, which is getting together with your family and friends and breaking bread. And that's it for this episode of the Stella Culinary School Podcast. Thanks so much for hanging in there and joining me for this episode. We covered a lot. And look, I know there's a lot of details with times and temperatures. All of that stuff is going to be in this episode's show notes, which you can find at stellaculinary.com/SCS25. Also, too, I plan on having one more podcast drop before Thanksgiving, and that is to answer your questions on Thanksgiving. We covered a lot in episode 24 and episode 25, all about Thanksgiving, your turkey and your sides. And if you have any questions, head on over to this episode's show notes, ask them there, or email me, jacob@stellaculinary.com. And until next time, this is Jacob Burton with stellaculinary.com, reminding you to cook with passion and have an amazingly awesome Thanksgiving. Thanks again, guys. Dude, I totally forgot to talk about Brussels sprouts. Oh, man, that SJ Dorse guy is going to kill me. All right, Brussels sprouts in the next episode. We're going to talk Culinary Q&A. All right, later, guys.